From West Virginia to Hawaii, Oklahoma to New York, this is American Radio Journal. On this edition, a number of states have gone to court in an effort to block President Trump's declaration of a national emergency to fund construction of the border wall. Do they have a case? Hillsdale College history professor Paul Ray is here to discuss. Bernie Sanders is the latest entry into what is becoming a crowded field of contenders for the 2020 Democrat presidential nomination. Scott Parkinson of the Club for Growth is here with the real story. In a rare unanimous ruling, the Supreme Court of the United States strengthened individual rights against unreasonable asset forfeiture. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details. And in the battle over the border wall, both sides are using irresponsible rhetoric. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA talks about it on this week's American Radio Journal Commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to American Radio Journal. After Congress rejected repeated proposals to provide adequate funding to secure the nation's southern border, President Trump declared the situation a national emergency. That has prompted a wave of lawsuits. Here to take a look at the validity of that legal action is Hillsdale College history professor Paul Ray. Paul, welcome to American Radio Journal. Paul, when we talk about a president declaring a national emergency, for those who may not be familiar with exactly what that means, what does it mean when a president declares a national emergency?
There's a federal law that gives the president a great deal of discretion in this regard. And the point of it is that the president has the right to act when circumstances require it and to act quickly. And the law governs when this is possible and when this is not. And I believe there's something like 59 or 49 national emergencies have been declared since the 1980s, and that something like 38 of these declarations are still in effect. And they allow the expenditure of appropriated money that may have been meant for one purpose, but perhaps was broadly described, to be shifted to another purpose. And you can see with the size of our government and the vast number of things that it does, especially through the Defense Department, that there has to be a lot of discretion in expenditures because circumstances change. And you can't wait 3 months for Congress to debate the changed circumstances. You need to reallocate resources from one part of the defense budget to another part of the defense budget in order to meet the circumstances that exist. So this has been done quite frequently. And as you know, it's now being challenged. And there's at least 16, there may be more by now, attorney generals who are trying to challenge it in federal court. These are attorney generals of the various states. One question, and I think it's the first question that needs to be addressed, is whether the attorney generals of places like Michigan have standing to challenge this particular act of the president. And to have standing, you have to show that you are harmed. That is to say that you suffer something significant because of the presidential decision. And then what you do is you challenge whether the law is being properly applied. Michigan is a long ways away from our southern border. There are two states that have joined in the lawsuit, California and New Mexico. There may turn out to be more that are closer to the border. In fact, right on the border in those two cases. They may have some ground. I doubt that any sane judge, and of course there are judges who will, for partisan reasons, do just about anything, will accept the state, will accord standing to a place like Michigan.
As we look at these legal challenges that are being filed, Paul, is this something that has happened in the past when you've mentioned the numerous times that presidents have declared a national emergency? Have these past national emergencies been challenged in court?
Only one of them that I know of, and it goes back past the current law to Harry Truman. During the Korean War, there was a labor dispute involving the steel industry and unions. And there was danger that the steel industry would be shut down by a strike. And Harry Truman seized the assets of the steel industry. There was obvious harm there. That is to say, the people who owned those assets had standing. They went to court. It went all the way to the Supreme Court, and this seizure of their property was declared illegal.
And as we look at this power that the president is claiming that he has here and that other presidents have used with frequency, are there other areas beside a president declaring a national emergency where Congress has ceded or delegated its authority? And I'm thinking particularly the regulatory agencies. This is a rather routine thing for Congress to do, is it not?
Right. If you think of the executive agencies and their vast numbers of them, they've not only been ceded the authority to make decisions about where they're going to build their buildings, who they're going to hire. They've also been ceded by Congress the right to make regulations that have the force of law. Now, if you think about it in terms of building buildings and of hiring, Congress can't possibly deal with that. Those are executive functions and have been since the beginning of the American Republic. The Senate has to approve the highest level officials, the Secretary of State, say, or the Secretary of Defense. But when you get down to hiring in the civil service and so forth, Congress is not involved in the slightest. Now, the question of rulemaking, there's a challenge that's being made, and I think there will be some changes that come from the Supreme Court, because Congress seems to be delegating the legislative power to executive agencies. But that's not what's involved with this national emergency. Defending the border is one of the responsibilities of the president and the Department of Defense. Exactly how the border is to be defended is a matter of discretion unless Congress has intervened to say, no, you can't do that. I mean, there could be a congressional law that will restrict that power. There's none on the books.
And likely if Congress tries to put one on the books, it will be met with a presidential veto at this particular point in time.
Right. And I doubt that Congress will want to do that because it would restrict future presidents.
And there is a whole nother area of discussion as to whether this opens up the possibility that future presidents might more broadly interpret this power. And we'll discuss that on another edition of American Radio Journal. But for right now, we have been talking with Paul Ray, who is a professor of history at Hillsdale College. Paul, tell us a little bit about Hillsdale and where folks can go on the web to read more.
Hillsdale's a little college in southern Michigan. It's a traditional liberal arts college. Very old-fashioned in that regard. It has a traditional liberal arts curriculum, a very serious core curriculum involving the study of literature and philosophy and the Western heritage and the American heritage and so forth. We're unusual in having a required course on the United States Constitution. The only other institutions in America that require such a course are the military academies.
Paul, what would the website be where folks can go to learn more about Hillsdale?
www.hillsdale, H-I-L-L-S-D-A-L-E, one word, .edu.
Paul Ray, professor of history at Hillsdale College. Paul, thank you for being with us.
Okay, take care.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth is keeping tabs on races all around the country. And as we talk about 2020, a lot of the focus, of course, is on the presidential race, but we will have a number of U.S. Senate races and key congressional races around the country. So let's take an early look at those. Scott, good to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start out with the United States Senate. Republicans currently in control, and the bright spot for Republicans last year was an increase in their majority in the U.S. Senate. As we look to 2020, Scott, is that majority imperiled in any way?
Well, I think that Republicans in the Senate are in pretty good position right now. We're certainly watching to see if some of the members that have been really safe over the last decade or two are going to retire. There's a couple of open races that we're watching very closely, as well as some vulnerable Democrats that we want to take on with conservative candidates.
Let's take a look at the individual states. Which states do you see as battleground states in 2020?
Believe it or not, it's a traditionally very red state, but they have an incumbent Democrat, Doug Jones, senator from Alabama. This is a race that I think everybody in Washington is watching very, very closely to see what the Republican primary shakes out to be, which candidates get in. There are certainly some very, very strong names that we are hearing may test the waters to get in the race, some very familiar names, and a couple of very strong conservatives. Starting out, we've got our former Attorney General, Jeff Sessions. This was his seat before he joined the Trump administration, and I think that he's taken a close look to try to determine whether he wants to end his career after stepping out as the Attorney General, or if he wants to come back to the United States Senate, where he was a real power player. Other candidates include Representative Bradley Byrne, who is a good Republican. I think he's very, very strong on defense spending, a really, really smart individual. And then we have a rock-solid conservative with Gary Palmer, who I hope will make a decision whether or not he gets in the race in the next month or two.
Let's go west, and Arizona has been a state that had been reliably Republican. Last year, the Democrat won a very close race to take a Senate seat there. And then we had an appointment to the seat of the late United States Senator John McCain. That's up for election next year. This could be a bit of a challenge for Republicans, right?
That's right. John Kyle, after McCain's passing, former senator from Arizona, stepped away from the lobbying world and came back to the Senate for a short-lived stint and went back to lobbying. And then they went ahead and appointed Martha McSally, who was the Republican nominee against Kyrsten Sinema. Now we've got McSally likely to take on a very, very strong Democrat candidate, Mark Kelly, the husband of shooting victim Congresswoman Gabby Giffords. And he's an astronaut, a twin, and really trying to appeal to moderate voters and to voters of Latino descent.
Taking a look then at other Republican pickup opportunities beside the state of Alabama, any other states where Republicans might be able to expand their majority?
We hope so, but there aren't as many good seats for Republicans to pick up unless we see a retirement or two. A lot of these Democrats are pretty strong. If you look at older members like Ed Markey, you've got members that are running for the presidential field that are up for re-election as well, so it has to be determined whether or not they drop out and can make their filing deadlines to still get back in a race. But that might be an indicator if we could run somebody in, let's say, New Jersey and Cory Booker stepped off of the ballot as a senator, and then we had a strong Republican candidate in that state. But more than anything, I think it's about maintaining some of these very, very important Republican seats. First and foremost for us is Senator Ben Sasse from Nebraska. The Club for Growth endorsed Ben Sasse for this race, even though we don't know who his opponents are going to be or what his primary is going to shake out to be. This is a defender of economic freedom, somebody that has a lifetime rating of 97% with the Club for Growth. He's just been a real, real strong vote, a member that's been willing to take on the Republican establishment when they've had their big spending deals in front of them. He's always voted consistently, so we're happy to endorse Ben Sasse, and we're really hoping that we can be helpful with our resources to make sure he comes back to the Senate.
We will see Republicans looking to defend and preserve seats in a majority, Democrats trying to maybe narrow that margin a bit. Let's take a look now at the United States House of Representatives. Even before we start talking about what could happen there next year, and of course that's a situation that is still yet to take shape, there are a couple of open seats, one because of an unfortunate passing and another because of a resignation, where we're going to see special elections, particularly in Pennsylvania. What is the situation there?
In Pennsylvania, on March 2nd, there's going to be a convention. And at this convention, there's going to be 202 conferees, and they will be deciding who will replace Congressman Tom Marino. Tom Marino was somebody that actually struggled with the Club for Growth scorecard. He had a Club for Growth lifetime rating of only 56%, but he resigned on January 23rd, reportedly due to health issues. So the special election itself will take place on May 21st. It's traditionally, even after redistricting, an area that is a bright red district, but we do have a little bit of concern that when there's no other game in town, these special elections can tighten, and there's a lot of money that goes through it. So we're watching really closely to see who the Republican nominee is, that emerges from the March 2nd convention.
And that convention, of course, it's interesting, Scott, there's something like 25, 26 individuals have put forth their name for consideration by the conferees at that convention. It's pretty hard to tell at this point who might emerge from that scrum. Scott Parkinson is with the Club for Growth. Scott, tell us a bit about the club.
The Club for Growth is a membership organization based out of our nation's capital. And if your listeners are interested, they can check out our website, www.clubforgrowth.org.
Scott Parkinson at the Club for Growth. Scott, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
The right of individuals not to have their personal property unreasonably seized by state and local governments has been strengthened by a unanimous U.S. Supreme Court ruling. Eric Boehm of Reason Magazine has details.
States are bound by the Eighth Amendment's prohibition against excessive fines and fees when they seek to seize property or other assets from individuals who have been charged or convicted of a crime. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court ruled unanimously last week, and it's a huge ruling. It's one that could have major ramifications for states and local governments that engage in the practice known as civil asset forfeiture, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Hi, folks. I'm Eric Boehm with Reason Magazine. Thanks for joining us on this edition of American Radio Journal. And if you're a regular listener to this program, then you're probably at least somewhat familiar with the Timms v. Indiana case that was in front of the Supreme Court in the latter part of last year. The court handed down its decision last week, and it was a unanimous victory, 9-0, for Tyson Timms, the plaintiff. And that case, as I said, it has potentially huge ramifications. But to understand why, you really have to go back and look at the backgrounds of the case. So for anybody who isn't familiar, here's how Sam Gedge, an attorney with the Institute for Justice and one of the co-counsels who argued the case in front of the Supreme Court, here's how Gedge explained the background of the case to me on an episode of American Radio Journal in November of last year.
So about 6 years ago, the state of Indiana took Tyson's car, saying that it was connected to a drug offense. Tyson at the time was addicted to heroin, and he'd sold a very small quantity of heroin to people who ended up being undercover police officers. So for the past 6 years, he's been fighting to get his car back. And the issue that has brought us to the U.S. Supreme Court is a simple issue, but a really important one, namely whether the excessive fines clause in the Eighth Amendment, whether that clause applies at all to the states.
So the important takeaway here is that Tyson Timms pleaded guilty to his crimes. He was convicted and he was sentenced to 1 year of house arrest, 5 years of probation. Then on top of that, the state of Indiana seized his 2012 Land Rover. That's a $42,000 truck. And he had bought that truck with money that he received from his late father's life insurance payout. It was not the ill-gotten gains of drug trade or anything like that. But the state took it anyway, despite the fact that potential fines for the crimes that he was convicted of were capped at only $10,000. So they essentially fined him four times by taking his truck, four times more than what the law says they were allowed to fine him if it had just been a pure monetary fine. And so it was on the basis of that that Timms challenged the seizure of his truck. And he argued that the vehicle, that the state taking the vehicle was effectively an additional fine on top of the sentence that he was already receiving and already paying for his crimes. The Indiana Supreme Court rejected that argument because they said the only reason they rejected it was because the U.S. Supreme Court had never explicitly stated that the Eighth Amendment applied to the states, that the excessive fines and fees clause in the Eighth Amendment applied to the states. So last week in this case in front of the Supreme Court, that's exactly what the justices did with a 9-0 decision. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the opinion, the majority opinion, the only opinion, and she said that for good reason, the protection against excessive fines has been a constant shield throughout Anglo-American history. Excessive fines can be used, for example, to retaliate against or chill the speech of political enemies. And she also wrote about how it could become a source of revenue for governments completely unconnected from the criminal justice system and about the sort of negative externalities that that would create. And indeed, some local governments do use fines and fees as a means to raise revenue. And that does create some pretty perverse incentives to target residents. After the 2014 shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, for example, a federal investigation into that city's government found that 20% of its revenue came from have criminal fines, and Ferguson is not alone in relying heavily on revenue from fines. So making it clear that the Eighth Amendment applies to states and to local governments will make it far easier for groups like the Institute for Justice, for example, to challenge those unreasonable fines and fees. And some of those cases are already getting teed up. A federal class action civil rights lawsuit that challenges the aggressive asset forfeiture program in Wayne County, Michigan, was filed in December, and it argues, among a bunch of other things, that the county's seizure of a 2015 Kia Soul truck is also an excessive fine because the owner was caught with just $10 worth of marijuana, and taking an entire car worth $20,000 is not an appropriate punishment. The Institute for Justice is also litigating a number of cases that have to do with cities imposing excessive fines on residents for having everything from unapproved paint jobs to having mismatched curtains hanging in their front windows. There are some just really ridiculous examples there. More broadly, I think the Timms case is a good reminder of just how ridiculous the argument in favor of civil asset forfeiture really is when you get right down to it. And that was exposed also at the Supreme Court during the oral arguments back in November, when Indiana's Solicitor General got boxed into a rhetorical corner by Justice Stephen Breyer. So let's go back to Sam Gedge again. This is him explaining to me in November what happened at the oral arguments between Breyer and the Indiana Solicitor General.
I think Justice Breyer really homed in on the potential for civil forfeitures to quickly become disproportionate. He asked Indiana's lawyer whether it would be constitutional for a state to say that any car that speeds 5 miles over the speed limit is automatically subject to forfeiture. And the car he used as an example is a Bugatti, which I'm told is a very expensive car, like $250,000. And the state of Indiana's lawyer had to stand up there and say, yes, you know, if we passed the law, then we could forfeit a Bugatti or a Lamborghini simply because it went 5 miles over the speed limit. And I think that's a tough case to make with a straight face.
Indeed, I think it's fair to say that if a state government thinks it has the authority to impound a car over a speeding ticket, that's a problem. And civil asset forfeiture has become a much bigger problem than that. It can be useful in some cases, for sure, but it's too easily abused by police forces, and it has become really a dangerous affront to basic civil liberties because they are unconstitutional, excessive punishments that don't fit the crime. And now we know that if the Eighth Amendment applies to actions taken by states and by local governments, that means civil asset forfeiture comes under a significantly increased level of scrutiny in the court system. And I think that's something that is only good for Americans and Americans' civil liberties as we move forward. For Reason Magazine, I'm Eric Boehm. You can check out our ongoing coverage of the Supreme Court, including our coverage of the Timms case, at Reason.com. And I'll be right back here next week with a guest on another edition of American Radio Journal.
The proposed wall or fence along the nation's southern border has resulted in some overheated rhetoric on both sides. Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring USA explains why sound logic should prevail on this week's American Radio Journal commentary.
Demagoguery is one of the lowest, most disreputable forms of expression, and it's not only alive but growing in our 21st century political discourse. So that we're totally clear on just what constitutes demagoguery, I'll read the definition of the word from the Oxford Dictionary. Political activity or practices that seek support by appealing to the desires and prejudices of ordinary people rather than by using rational arguments. Got that? It's political speech that is rooted in emotion, desires and prejudices, rather than reason. One of the most demagogued issues in the current season is President Trump's proposed border wall, and it happens from both sides. An example of leftist demagoguery is this from former Congressman and presidential hopeful Beto O'Rourke. "We know that walls do not save lives, walls end lives." Well, the only truth in that statement is that because walls do indeed work to discourage illegal entries, if the wall ends somewhere out in the hot desert, far away from a city, town, or road, some migrants will attempt to cross out there and might die in the heat. In other words, the wall forces them into a risky crossing area. If there were no walls at all, then an unlimited number of illegal crossers could just saunter into our country, unimpeded by anything, and that would be safer. Is that what they want? What nonsense. That's like saying that a strong bank safe causes attempted robbers to risk their lives in an effort to get at the money inside, and therefore safes end lives. Maybe Mr. O'Rourke wants them, too, to have easier, safer access to the bank's money. Another nonsensical argument that opponents of the wall make is that walls don't work because they can be scaled. The former governor of Arizona, Janet Napolitano, famously said that even if a wall were built 50 feet high, it could be easily defeated with a 51-foot ladder. What nonsense. And let's not forget Speaker Nancy Pelosi's petulance in saying not $1 for the president's wall. That's not the kind of language one should expect from a leader. Demagoguery on the right stokes fear of immigrants by telling the true stories of murders and other violence caused by criminals who entered illegally or overstayed their visas in our country, implying that immigrants as a class are dangerous. Vicious cartels is one descriptor. Therefore, they argue, a wall that keeps illegal crossers out makes us safer. Well, that's undeniably true, but saying it clumsily can easily be twisted into accusations of racism, xenophobia, and hate. So let's try a different approach. How about a little common sense? A border is expected by most people to be, in fact, a border, a line which one may cross only with the explicit permission of those whose land the crosser seeks to enter. If that border is to be secure, it needs three elements to secure it, not one. First, there must be some form of physical barrier. Secondly, there must be some set of human agents enforcing the barrier. And finally, because we cannot afford to have one agent every few feet along a nearly 2,000-mile border, there must be some attempted crossing detection technology that would permit surveillance over a wide distance. You need all three elements, barrier, manpower, and technology, to secure the border effectively. A wall or fence alone can be breached, and the president never argued for a wall by itself. Trying to secure the border by manpower by itself requires greater numbers than would ever be feasible. Technology is great for detection, but not for enforcement. You need all three. Take any one away, and the other two must be increased to impractical levels. But if you deploy all three at appropriate levels, you'll be able to secure the border so that illegal crossings drop to a trickle. That's the argument that should be made by the president to the Beto O'Rourkes, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes, and the like. One without hate, fear, or the invocation of irrational emotion. And if they still oppose that argument, then they will have exposed the fact that they really do not want a secure border. They want a flood of illegal crossers to become citizens for political purposes or as potential victims to be exploited by employers seeking cheap labor. Those two motives are immoral and irresponsible. This has been Colin Hanna of Let Freedom Ring for American Radio Journal. Visit us on the web at letfreedomringusa.com.
American Radio Journal is heard on public affairs-minded radio stations all across the country, including our newest affiliates, KZOY AM and FM in Sioux Falls, North Dakota. Welcome to our new listeners in the Peace Garden State. American Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, which underwrite the costs of this program. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. Learn more about American Radio Journal and hear expanded versions of some interviews aired on this program. Please visit our website, AmericanRadioJournal.com. I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to American Radio Journal. American Radio Journal, lighting the brush fires of freedom.